A few weeks ago, to widespread bewilderment, President Emmanuel Macron of France allowed, perchance encouraged, the publication of photos of himself in moody black and white, pummeling a punch bag, his face a rictus of pugnacious resolve, his biceps purposefully athrob. Many inferred that Macron intended these pictures as a representation of his determination to play Muhammad Ali to the sunny Liston of Russian President Vladimir Putin, the sprightly upstart shaping to dispatch the glowering ogre. And Macron has lately taken a notably harder line on Russia, even conspicuously refusing to rule out the prospect of Western troops being deployed in Ukraine's defence. If one were attempting to win some sort of prize for understatement, one might well say that President Macron does not lack a sense of the grandeur of the office he occupies. But with 7 years of his presidency gone and at most three more to go, it is worth asking if there is, as yet, a coherent Macron doctrine, and if so, what results it has had. Has Emmanuel Macron had any notable foreign policy successes? Have France's recent foreign policy reverses really been entirely his fault? And what actually would happen if France or anyone else really did help Ukraine more directly? This is The Foreign Desk.
I think that the problem for Macron has often been his excessive belief in his capacity to use his personal powers of persuasion to make a difference. We saw that with Trump, we saw that with Putin, we've seen that in a number of other theatres, and I think that that has been where France has fallen down.
In 2017, when he convened the recently elected members of parliament, he told them, make no mistake about it, we have 5 years. And in 5 years, if we fail, Marine Le Pen will come to power. So I do believe that he's very concerned that whatever happened in 2027, he does not want to be seen as the one who gave the keys of France to the leader of the National Rally. That's for sure.
The only way to play the game with Putin is through strength. Anything else, any sign of weakness, he will take a mile instead of an inch.
You're listening to The Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. Later in the show, we will be talking to Sir Richard Sheriff, the former British General and Deputy Supreme Allied Commander Europe at NATO. But joining me now from Paris is Dr. Bruno Tertre, Deputy Director at the Foundation for Strategic Research and Senior Fellow at Institut Montaigne. Bruno formerly worked at NATO's Parliamentary Assembly and the French Ministry of Defence. Also with us is Sophie Pedder, a Paris-based journalist and author of Revolution Française, Emmanuel Macron, and the quest to reinvent a nation. Sophie, let's start with the approximate jumping-off point of this episode, which is those photos that circulated a couple of weeks back of President Macron in sweaty black and white wailing away at a punching bag. Is it clear to you what he was hoping to communicate with that?
It's a good question. I was very struck by the fact that the UK press jumped on this, and I think it made the front page of at least one paper. If you look at what the origin of those photos is, there is an official photographer at the Elysee called Soazig de la Moissonnière, who follows him around all the time, and she publishes a lot of these photos on her Instagram account. They're not published on the Elysee official account at all. And they're often, you know, when he's doing some sports workout or he's jumping out of a helicopter or he's, you know, presiding over a much more serious event. But they are photos that are constantly out there. So this wasn't a photo shoot that was sort of arranged just around the boxing. But having said that, of course, the timing was quite interesting. And nothing is completely anodyne when it comes to Macron. He's extremely careful of how his image is perceived. And the fact that he was there, you know, boxing at the time when he's hardened his stance towards Russia, I think is very interesting. It cannot have been coincidental, the message that was, you know, sort of non-explicitly being sent with those images.
Well, let's address the subject perhaps behind the photographic metaphor. And to bring you in, Bruno, does it strike you that President Macron actually has significantly adjusted his position on Russia? And if he has, why has he?
Well, I think he has, but it has been a slow train coming, a slow motion evolution from his last-ditch attempt to negotiate with Putin in early 2022 to the present day. I think the evolution is real. I'm fond of saying that he was sort of mugged by reality. I think he generally thought that he could bring Putin to the negotiating table, avoid war. He was still thinking a few months ago about the so-called new security architecture for Europe, etc. But I think that, you know, over time he has convinced himself that, you know, you could not do a deal with Putin. I think that more interesting, in the past few weeks, a couple of things happened that led him to take a much more forceful stance, which was exemplified by his outburst about sending ground troops. But first of all, the situation in Ukraine is, you know, pretty dire, or at least it's not favorable. The military assistance to Ukraine from the United States is actually encountering difficulties in Congress. The Trump scenario is getting more credible by the day. And Russia seems to be having, forgive me for saying so, a pretty good time. That is, there is the perception that, you know, Putin believes that time is on his side and that the situation on the ground is not doing too badly for Russia. So for all these reasons, I think this was the culmination of a long process of evolution, political and intellectual evolution for Macron. And that explains why, you know, over time, from the famous Bratislava speech of June 2023 up to February 2024, the evolution has been completed, so to say. So, yes, there is a pivot.
Sophie, I just want to pick up that suggestion that President Macron made that France might, in certain circumstances, actually send troops to Ukraine. Does that strike you as something actually imaginable? Was he just trying to see what the public mood might be?
I'll answer that question, Andrew, in 1 minute, but I'd just like to come back to something that Bruno said, because, you know, I agree with everything that he's just said. I would add one thing, and that is a real sense in Paris that France itself and French national interests are increasingly being threatened and France being targeted by Russia. And you've seen this in the spreading of rumours about French mercenaries being in Ukraine, about France being ready to send in 20,000 troops, all sorts of things that are not true, or at least have been, you know, denied and announced as fake by the French authorities, and in conventional space as well, because we've had an issue with French fighter pilots on the West Black Sea having been threatened by the Russians. So I think that France feels that part of the reason that Macron's taken this hardened stance is also because France feels particularly threatened and targeted. To your bigger question, I think that, you know, you need to remember the context. This was a press conference after the summit that France had called on February 26. And Macron started off in his opening remarks by saying there was no consensus on this question of ground forces. But in answer to a question, he did say it would not be ruled out. So what he was trying to do, I think, is lay out or defend or put out there in the public, remind people about the concept of strategic ambiguity. That's to say, he's not going to say what his red lines are. He's not going to rule out doing things, but that doesn't mean he's about to do them either. And the trouble is, I think, partly was the phrasing, and he talked about ground troops, and ground troops to the French mind and to the minds of pretty much everyone else sounded as if there were going to be, you know, forces, young men sent to the front line. Macron then had to backpedal and talk about non-combat forces, perhaps training missions. So the problem was compounded by the use of the word, I think. Having said that, you know, I think Macron just wanted to move that conversation forward and put that subject out there.
Bruno, we did want to broaden out into a wider discussion of President Macron's foreign policy and his approach to it. And I'm just wondering if maybe those remarks that he made about the possibility of sending troops to Ukraine might fit in with a general pattern of impetuousness, or just saying things that pop into his head, or indeed doing things that pop into his head. One thinks most obviously of his strange dash to Beirut a matter of days after the huge port explosion in the summer of 2020.
I think what happened regarding Ukraine is actually exactly the opposite of his impetuous dash to Beirut, as you rightly put it. He is impetuous, and journalists and commentators and advisors actually scratch their head anytime he opens his mouth on the plane and talks loosely to reporters and journalists. I'm sure that Sophie knows very well what I'm talking about. But this is actually in contrast with what happened in Beirut. I think he was generally convinced that France, as it has sometimes done in the past, could play an important role in Lebanon, as the situation was blocked at the time and the explosion report revealed all the fragilities of Lebanon. And the warm welcome that he got at that time probably convinced him, you know, he's a fairly egocentric person, then that he could actually do something just by being there and telling, you know, the political forces what to do, and which is absolutely not what happened, obviously. But fast forward to March 2024, I think what happened regarding Ukraine, the question Grant, was exactly the opposite. This was a slow evolution. This was not impetuous, even though I don't know how much the answer to the question that was raised during the press conference was actually prepared or not. It's actually a better crafted response to a geopolitical situation than Lebanon was. And maybe even if there was, you know, a little bit of improvisation, this was a deliberate provocation, so to say.
Sophie, we've had a good few years now to get used to President Macron as a player on the global stage, and foreign policy is clearly something he does take seriously, and he is very invested in France's place in the world. All that taken into consideration, could we say at this point that he has had any significant foreign policy successes?
I mean, it's a good question. I think you have to put his attempts to represent France on the world stage in the general context of the French foreign policy over the past decade or more. You know, France has a concept of itself, of its place in the world. It thinks it stands up for universal values. It thinks that it has a particular and singular voice that is different to that even of its other Western allies. And I think, therefore, that Macron is very much sort of, there's a form of continuity in what he's tried to do, which is no greatly different to that of Sarkozy or Chirac or any of the earlier Fifth Republic presidents. I think that the problem for Macron has often been his excessive belief in his capacity to use his personal powers of persuasion to make a difference. We saw that with Trump. We saw that with Putin, as Bruno reminded us. We've seen that in a number of other theatres. And I think that that has been where France has fallen down. I would say, having said that, that the greatest foreign policy success for Macron will be Europe. And when I say Europe, what I mean by that is what he has done, I think, is bring the conversation forward. He's put subjects on the table that at the time have felt sort of out there, outrageous, provocative. You know, think back to when he told us that NATO was brain dead and that Europe needed to think more about its own defense and have a kind of more autonomous vision of collective defense for the continent. Think about joint issuing of debts, which he had raised well before COVID. These things at the time felt provocative, unnecessary, unhelpful. Allies bristled, but they have become part of, if not, you know, reality, like joint issue of debt, they have become part of the way people are beginning to think. So I would say in that respect, it's sort of France as a kind of a power of ideas, a power of initiatives, a power of sort of ability to move the conversation on that will probably in Europe, at least, be one of his sort of big legacies.
Sophie, on the subject of Europe, though, in terms of his recent remarks about Ukraine and Russia and also his participation in the attempt to revive the so-called Weimar Triangle, a bloc constituting France, Germany and Poland, do you get a sense as well that he is trying to ingratiate France a bit better with the two big rising powers in the east of the continent? Poland, obviously, which is already a member of the EU and NATO, and Ukraine, which presumably in due course will be.
This is part of what I think has been one of the biggest shifts in Macron's foreign policy within Europe. And that has been a realization that the role of Central and Eastern Europe, whether inside or outside the EU, is absolutely crucial to the future of the security on the continent, and that therefore projects such as enlargement of the EU, which in the past France has been pretty against and indeed has sometimes blocked. Think back to when the UK was part of the European Union. Enlargement was very much in line with British thinking. You know, the more you could sort of dilute power across the continent, the more you could, you know, dilute the sort of role of Brussels. That was the way the UK, you know, to sort of simplify, thought about enlargement. enlargement, whereas France thought enlargement was going to be there to threaten its own importance within the EU. Well, the fact that France has emerged as a sort of champion of EU enlargement to Ukraine, the fact that France has now really won, I think, surprising amount of support from both Baltic states, from Poland, from Romania, from Moldova, both, so again, in and out of the EU from Central and Eastern Europe, is absolutely an absolute turnaround. And by support, I mean for the idea of taking a harder line against Russia. On Poland in particular, it's interesting. I mean, I think part of the issue is that France and Germany have got this very difficult relationship at the moment. Scholz and Macron find it quite difficult to get on, to read each other, to find a kind of way to cooperate constructively. They've been sniping in public at each other. Scholz, do you remember that tweet after the February summit in France where Scholz ruled out on behalf of NATO and Europe sending in ground troops to Ukraine, which is not really his role to do. And Macron have sniped at Scholz implicitly in his own comments, saying that some people, you know, used to just talk about sending helmets to Ukraine. That sort of relationship has become so difficult, so tricky at the level of the leaders of those countries that having Poland in the game is actually quite useful for both France and it's helpful for Germany so that they don't have to just be in this sort of confrontational situation all the time.
Bruno, one region in the world where France has unarguably lost influence is Africa, specifically in the countries Mali, Burkina Faso and Niger, which have undergone military coups and afterwards sought to close down their relationships diplomatically and militarily with France. That may not have been entirely Macron's fault, but does the loss of French influence in Africa, especially in those three countries, dent his foreign policy legacy?
Well, it's a bit early to say. There's several dimensions here. First of all, it was always planned that the major deployments of French forces in the Sahel region after 2013 would have to come to an end at some point, and Macron just accelerated it. I mean, I remember, by the way, that by the launch of this major Operation Barkhane in 2014, the Joint Staff at the time thought that it would last 3 or 4 years maximum. So first dimension is that, you know, this drawdown of the French military presence was always to come to an end. Remember that there was no French military presence in Mali before 2013. Then there is a second dimension, which is the fact that as a number of African countries go back, unfortunately, to their authoritarian traditions, then France has an impossible choice to make, you know, continue to assist them at the risk of sounding like a country which once again is cozying up to dictators, etc., or distance itself. And, you know, the choice was made to distance itself. But the third parameter, obviously, is the Russian factor, where Russia has been very keen to say, well, France is putting conditions to its assistance. It doesn't like you because you're authoritarian governments. Well, we're here to help. But the final dimension is that France's presence in Africa is bound to remain, if only because of a large number of French nationals or dual nationals on the continent. And it's broader than just the Sahel region and the three countries we talked about.
We are coming towards concluding remarks in our assessment of President Macron as a foreign policy president. And I'll put it to you, Sophie, because I know you've had these conversations with President Macron directly, and it would not be an unreasonable position for him to arrive at. But does he now see France as not only the default leader of Europe, because after Brexit, it is, of course, the only country which is all at once in the EU and in NATO, the permanent five of the Security Council at the UN. It's the EU's only nuclear-armed power. Does he also think, if Trump is re-elected, that France then is the leader of the entire free West and he, by default, the leader of the free world?
Look, I don't think, you know, Macron has huge powers of self-belief, but I think that even he doesn't think that he is the leader of Europe. I think he understands that France can't do anything alone, that France has to work with allies. And one of the things I found very interesting is that in as far as the Franco-German relationship has been difficult in kind of trying to move things forward, particularly with regards to Ukraine, Macron has increasingly reached out and really worked at building alliances with other European countries. So that's EU members. We've seen that with the Baltics. We've seen that with Moldova is a really interesting case. France is incredibly invested in Moldova and in Romania, where there's French military presence as part of the NATO force there. So I think that Macron sees He has a leading role in terms of contributing ideas, which we've mentioned earlier. I think that he sees his role as a sort of convening power. He has an ability to put together meetings, ideas, or bring people around the table. And he likes to sort of break the ice. You know, once he used this image of himself as a kind of icebreaker, you know, he goes in and says things that people don't necessarily want to hear, but he thinks it's useful, however much it irritates people, because it sort of, it helps bring things forward. So yes, with Trump, Europe needs leadership. Yes, it's difficult when Scholz isn't offering that leadership and there aren't obvious alternatives. But I think, you know, even Macron would see he has a leadership role, but I don't think he sees himself as the only leader. And one last point on that is that you mentioned the word Europe to refer to the EU. Mm-hmm. I think that Macron's concept, or his conception rather, of Europe is broader and would see the UK as part of that leadership, and particularly and obviously when it comes to defence and security.
And just finally, and as briefly if possible, Bruno, we are looking ahead to European parliamentary elections. It is widely anticipated that Marine Le Pen's national rally will deal Macron's Renaissance list a bit of a thumping. When Macron considers the future, and obviously he cannot run again for the presidency of France, do you think he is concerned about what his legacy might end up looking like, whether he thinks it will last or be dismantled by his successor?
Let me start with a quick anecdote. In 2017, when he convened the recently elected members of parliament, he told them, make no mistake about it, we have 5 years. And in 5 years, if we fail, Marine Le Pen will come to power. So I do believe that he's very concerned that whatever happened in 2027, he does not want to be seen as the one who gave the keys of France to the leader of the national rally. That's for sure. That being said, one cannot know who he will support for the 2027 election. But regarding the elections at the European Parliament, this is not seen in France as a perfect barometer of political forces. Of course, he's expecting a kind of a de facto defeat, but this is not necessarily seen in France as a harbinger of things to come in 5 years from now.
Sophie Pedder and Bruno Tertre, thank you both very much for joining us here on the Foreign Desk. You're listening to The Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. Emmanuel Macron's refusal, since reiterated, to rule out sending troops to Ukraine prompted an aghast scramble for distance from this position from many of France's NATO allies. The US, the UK and Germany all issued statements along the lines of, hell no, we won't go. But what would happen if France and or similarly inclined partners did it anyway? Well, I'm joined now by the former British General, Sir Richard Sheriff, who served as NATO's Deputy Supreme Allied Commander Europe from 2011 to 2014. Sir Richard, let's talk a bit about what France and Poland have hinted at in theory. If either of them or any other NATO member wanted to act unilaterally on the ground in Ukraine, is there anything stopping them from doing that independently of NATO?
No, I don't think there is. There's nothing stopping countries acting bilaterally with Ukraine. And in fact, all the action thus far has been largely bilateral between individual countries, NATO states, or not NATO states necessarily, other partner nations and Ukraine. Thinking about the question, though, you know, if you're seriously upping the ante, there is always the risk that it impacts on alliance cohesion. So thus far, bilateral actions have been in line with NATO, you know, the NATO intent to support Ukraine. Up the ante any further, given that NATO is, what, 32 nation states now, member states, you know, there's got to be a degree of consensus in what's going on. Otherwise, it's going to weaken the alliance.
So it's possible that unilateral or bilateral action of that kind might occasion an amount of nervousness in non-participating NATO nations?
I think certainly the sort of, you know, a decision by a NATO country such as France or Poland to put, for example, troops on the ground to engage in combat operations would absolutely generate a degree of nervousness, more than a degree of nervousness. I think it would really strike at alliance cohesion.
Because would a Russian engagement with soldiers from a NATO country operating in Ukraine, i.e. outside their own territory, would that necessarily be an Article 5 kind of moment that would oblige the rest of NATO to join in?
No, I don't think it would. Article 5 is about an armed attack on a NATO member state and an armed attack on NATO soldiers or soldiers from a NATO state operating outside the transatlantic boundaries, I don't think would constitute an Article 5.
Which does bring us, I guess, to the question that Macron was implicitly posing, which is whether militarily unilateral or bilateral action of that kind would actually make a decisive difference on the ground. We are, of course, now getting on for a year past the much vaunted Ukrainian counteroffensive, which did not make the gains that might have been hoped for. We might be a matter of months away from the United States re-electing Donald Trump, which could obviously change the dynamic considerably. So if, again, in theory, two nations of the capacities of France and or Poland joined in properly, would that actually make militarily a decisive difference?
Oh, I think it would, unquestionably. And France and Poland are both very capable military states. I think Poland is way out in front in the league of European member states in terms of defense spending. It has significantly increased the size and capability of its armed forces. And as you say, hypothetically, if they were to get involved in support of Ukraine, it would absolutely make a difference militarily. But at the same time, of course, it would also have some very far-reaching implications.
Well, indeed so, one of which would be that it would certainly provoke Russia to, at the very least, rattling its nuclear saber yet again. But if, again, going back to President Macron's remarks, one of the nations involved is France, which is a nuclear-armed power, would such a deployment actually alter the dynamic in terms of how the nuclear deterrent works? Because presumably Russia would then have to be mindful of France's potential to retaliate.
Yeah, again, we're talking hypotheticals here, but I can't see how it doesn't change the stakes in terms of nuclear deterrence. Clearly, it would depend on the nature and scale and type of operation. Russia has always said that it would not use its nuclear deterrent unless Russian territory, the motherland, was attacked. Now, Putin conveniently includes now in the so-called motherland territory that he has annexed from Ukraine, or supposedly annexed from Ukraine, the separatist states of Donbass and Luhansk, for example. So it would change the dynamic. It would certainly create a degree of fragility and nervousness, serious nervousness across the alliance.
But how mindful should France or indeed anybody else in NATO be at this point about what we understand of Vladimir Putin's doctrines in terms of nuclear and other retaliation? Because as we have seen time and time again, it will be whatever he decides it is that suits his narrative at a given moment, won't it? The entire 10 years of invasion of Ukraine is rooted in this bizarre fantasy he has that anybody in Western Europe is interested in the acquisition of an inch of Russian territory.
Yeah, and of course, whatever doctrine is supposedly laid down is pretty well irrelevant to Putin. He'll use whatever power is at his disposal to use it. So strength in opposing him, absolute resolution across the board in the alliance, really taking the gloves off and giving Ukraine the means it needs to not only hold against Russia, but defeat Russia. We're a heck of a long way away from that at the moment. And not giving in to nuclear blackmail as well. I'm sure the only way to play the game with Putin is through strength. Anything else, any sign of weakness, he will take a mile instead of an inch.
The question that then arises, especially if we are thinking in terms of the time constraints which may be prevailing upon Ukraine, the potential re-election of Donald Trump in the United States, the fact that Ukraine has incurred shocking casualties and cannot do this forever. From where we are now, can Ukraine realistically achieve that military victory over Russia without such an intervention as we've been discussing, i.e. without reinforcements on the ground from its allies?
I think it could without on-the-ground reinforcement, but only if the NATO countries supporting Ukraine across the board mobilize themselves in a way which has not yet happened, mobilize the military-industrial base, and really turn on the screws and increase the flow of ammunition and weaponry and aircraft and other support to Ukraine. Now, of course, time is running out, and it takes time to do that. But it's better to start now than not to start at all. And I think if the West really did that now, starting now, let's say the flow begins to come through in 6, 9, even 12 months' time, I think Ukraine would be able to hold on long enough for that flow to make a difference, for 2024 be the year of holding, for 2025, 2026 to be the year when Ukraine begins to relentlessly push Russia back, but only if the West mobilizes.
And to bring all that back to the theme of this episode, does it strike you that France does sort of loom as the obvious leader of such an enterprise, being that it is, as we will have discussed elsewhere, the only country which is all at once a member of the EU, NATO, and the permanent five of the Security Council, is the EU's only nuclear-armed power? Is France actually the decisive factor here?
I think France is a decisive factor. Anyway, frankly, it's good to see it at last a European leader of a major European power stepping up to the mark. I mean, we've got a number of European leaders in countries like Estonia, in Denmark, Poland now with Donald Tusk, who are stepping up to the mark. But France is in a different order of magnitude. Germany and Britain have been nowhere, frankly, have been very quiet. I mean, Britain did well to begin with. Germany continues to be the largest supplier in terms of cash and other capability and military capabilities. But President Scholz and Prime Minister Sunak are keeping well in the background when it comes to taking a lead. I think France is clearly the obvious candidate, but France has got to put its money where its mouth is. It's one thing for President Macron to take a lead, and that's good news. But, you know, he's got to be backed up by France really delivering on the military support side. And it goes back to my point earlier about the need to really mobilize the military industrial base across NATO in France and Germany and Britain, as well as across the board.
Sir Richard, thank you for joining us. That was General Sir Richard Sheriff, former Deputy Supreme Allied Commander Europe at NATO. And that's it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week, and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. The Foreign Desk was produced by Emma Searle and Christy O'Grady. Christy also produces The Foreign Desk Explainer. Don't forget to subscribe to Monocle Magazine and to our free daily email bulletins by heading to our website at monocle.com. From me, Andrew Muller, thanks very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.